You also had a guy asking about his handy talkie. When he holds on it with his hand or puts it on the table, he hears very different response. Does that ring a bell, Roy? Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a few other questions. I'll move on to the next question that I have. A gentleman said that he has a Baofeng handy talkie that's very noisy and doesn't hold the repeater. He also has a PSEG in the neighborhood. They installed some wireless networks to support their smart meters, which are installed across his island. He was wondering if anyone knows what frequencies they operate and what format they're using. He wants to know if there are any listeners that have them, and so if they noticed an increase or a decrease in the usual usage of their handy talkie.
I believe there are some websites that are dedicated toward people with a scanner receiver, which list for you all of the frequencies of ambulance services, law enforcement, fire, police, everything. And Loco and Con Ed. So there are scanning-oriented websites that list all those frequencies. I'd like to believe somewhere there's one of those lists that'll tell you what frequencies PSEG is using between their headquarters and their linemen, which I think is what the question is. Back to you, Roy, KGRIW.
Yeah, that seems to be the gist of it. He was wondering if you or I or anyone else listening on the TechNet ever had any experience with these smart meter devices, and if they played around with trying to pick up the signal, and so they have a better idea of what frequencies to go looking for it.
WS2N.
You've got a ball.
If it's anything like the Water Authority, we here in Suffolk County have these transmitters attached to the water meters now. And what I understand, when I first had that done, I believe it was UHF, and there's a small lithium battery running it. It's supposed to be good for at least 5 years, but it doesn't continually transmit. It's only when they ride up and down a block, they'll transmit a signal, and then they'll pick it up. You know, it's one of those deals. So it's not like you have constant transmitting signals going all the time. So it might be that, you know, my guess it's a similar type of setup. Back to you, Roy.
I think they call that a transponder. So you interrogate the transponder when you drive by. Then it sends back a signal with the data. The rest of the time it's just sitting there quietly. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, that makes sense to me as well. And I looked up smart meters, and apparently the two main bands that most of the programs for is 902 megahertz and 2.4 gigahertz. You know, public bands, I guess, is what they are using. Well, shall we go to the next question?
Fire away.
Okay. Gentleman asks, why does a portable radio sometimes receive a signal better when he's holding it, and sometimes vice versa? Is my body reflecting the signal to the radio, or am I somehow grounding the radio even though it's plastic? He said he receives the TechNet at 147.375.141.3 much better while holding his scanner than if he sets it down on the counter.
I start off this conversation by talking about the non-symmetric dipole. I can start off with a dipole that's exactly a half wavelength long, and I feed it in the center the conventional manner. I could, if I want to, feed it halfway between the center and the end or from the outer end. If I feed it halfway between center and outer end, now the two halves of the dipole from my feed point of view, there's a big side and a small side. That's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it is I could continue feeding the dipole in the center, but I make the right-hand side out of an ordinary piece of wire, a quarter wavelength long. I make the left-hand side out of something that's much fatter and a little bit shorter than a quarter wavelength long, so that it'll look very different, but electronically, the left side is a quarter wavelength, and the right side is a quarter wavelength. So there's all kinds of ways you can unbalance. Now, when you take a rubber duck antenna sitting on top of a handy talkie, let me drop. The rubber duck antenna is a spirally wound thing, usually, which is close to an electronic quarter wavelength in length. The metal package of the other half of that antenna, the counterpoise, the bottom half, what you and I would call the ground, is usually physically considerably shorter, particularly on 2 meters. A quarter wavelength of 2 meters is 19 inches. The height of the metal package of your handy-talkie is almost always a lot less than 19 inches. So the rubber duck antenna plus its package is an unbalanced dipole. And electronically, they do that matching inside. There's going to be some reactance because it's not the right physical length. And if the transmitter was putting out 100 volts, you might have 75 of those volts, let me put it the other way, 25 of those volts appearing across the rubber duck and 75 of those volts appearing across the package when it's being held in free space. You've got your handy-talkie being suspended by a string in free space, and it's an unbalanced structure, like I said, with a bigger voltage on the package because the package is highly reactive, shorter than a quarter wavelength in physical length. You now wrap your hand around the outer plastic of that handy-talkie. Let me drop. Between that metal package, through the thin layer of plastic, into your hand, there is probably, let me pick a number, a 50 picofarad coupling capacitor. A relatively small amount of capacitor reactance between the metal package, through the plastic, into your hand. Your hand is now a more complicated conductive structure that's acting as a counterpoise. So the tuning of your rubber duck, even though you're not touching it, the tuning of the rubber duck changes when you've got the handy-talkie sitting on the table and you reach over and wrap your hand around the handy-talkie. You've changed the tuning. You've also changed the antenna pattern because you're now doing some of that radiating. In the case of the old days of radio-controlled model airplanes, when the radio control airplane used to work on 75 megacycles, you'd be holding onto the transmitter with a whip antenna coming out of the top of it, and you're holding that in front of your body, and you're controlling your airplane that's flying around out there. Turns out that a human being standing vertically has the right length standing on the ground so that your body is coming close to resonating at 75 megahertz. Let me drop. So when you held onto that radio control transmitter with that big whip antenna coming out of it, a hell of a lot of the signal was radiated by that whip, but I'll bet you 20% of the signal was being radiated by the coupling into your body and your body re-radiating the signal. There are people who would have ways of measuring the signal strength of what's being received by the airplane as they stood facing the airplane and then moved their body 180 degrees so that the airplane is behind them. And sometimes the signal getting to the airplane got stronger when they did that. Quite often it got weaker. So what is doing the radiating? The box, the whip, the hand, the arm, the body, and so on. You grab out of the handy-talkie, you're changing the antenna pattern, you're changing the tuning. That's some of what's going on. There's more than that. Let me drop. Choose a repeater that's giving you a fairly weak signal into your living room. And now you move your handy-talkie into that living room. You translate it in X, you translate it in Y, you translate it in Z. You now rotate it 90 degrees and repeat the procedure. So you can be rotating the handy-talkie from horizontal to vertical, pushing it forward, pulling it back, sliding it to the left, sliding it to the right, moving it up, moving it down. You do all those motions with your handy-talkie. You'll sometimes find that even though the repeater you're listening to, you know, is a pure vertically polarized signal, in certain portions of that room, you're going to get the stronger signal with the handy-talkie horizontal. When I'm listening to this repeater in my bathroom in the morning, I set my handy-talkie horizontal on a plastic shelf in the bathroom in order to get the stronger signal. Part of what's going on is that the signal is bouncing off of all kinds of things in the environment. As you move it around in that living room, you walk around, you'll find a number of hot spots and cold spots where the signal gets stronger and weaker, depending depending on your orientation, up, down, left, right, forward, and back, and whether or not it's horizontal, vertical, or slant 45 degrees with the orientation of the hanky-torky. You're seeing a beautiful example when you do that experiment. Let me drop. A beautiful example of multipath. And the multipath may be a little bit easier to envision in the transmit mode. If your handy-talkie is doing the transmitting, it wouldn't take very much convincing to lead you to believe that that signal coming out of your handy-talkie is reflecting off of every single object in that living room. The rug, the ceiling, the walls, the pictures, the knickknacks on the shelf, the television set. Some of it gets to the kitchen, is bouncing off the refrigerator, some of it's bouncing off the radiators and the water pipes and the wiring. In the transmit mode, all of those signals are bouncing all of those objects, and all of those bounce signals sum together as a very complemented three-dimensional vector. They eventually get to the repeater site. That's in the transmit mode. Because of the law of reciprocity, all of that multipathing that took place when you transmit, the exact same amount of multipathing at the exact same amplitude takes place when you're receiving. A little bit more difficult to envision that when you're receiving, but it's taking place. The law of reciprocity says whatever pattern you get out of an antenna, whatever performance you get when you transmit, you're going to get the exact same performance when you receive. So because of all the multipath going on, you're changing the pattern, you're changing the locations, you're changing how the signal is getting into the handy-talkie. When you touch it, when you move your hand nearby, when you move the handy-talkie to the left side of the table, the right side of the table, forward, back, go to a higher location, the shelf on the wall, and so on. All of that is proving to you that there's a lot of multipath taking place. That signal bounces off of every possible object in the environment. You can't stop it from doing that. When you're receiving it at that handy-talkie, let me drop. Assume I added up 1,000 of those individual multipath signal propagating conditions. Let's assume there's 1,000 of them. There's probably even more than that. You have 1,000 little individual vectors. By vector, I mean there's 1,000 voltages coming to that receiving antenna, small, large, in phase, out of phase, and so on. You add them all up considering the phase angle. That's what I mean by vector summing. You add that all up, and that's what the receiver in your handy-talkie is going to see. There are times when half of those signals are in phase and half of those signals on that multipath are out of phase, and you get a phase. So you would think that because you move the handy-talkie to a place where you don't hear the repeater, you would think it's getting no signal. Yes, the sum is zero, but there could be a hell of a lot of signal in phase and a hell of a lot of signal out of phase that are hitting your handy-talkie at that instant from that location. Ain't that crazy? That's some of what's going on. So it takes a lot of experimenting to find out what's the best. Let me drop. While this particular guy is getting a fairly noisy signal from his Baofeng into the repeater because he's using its antenna, if he established any kind of other antenna, particularly on the roof of the house, with any old ratty piece of coax cable coming down into the house, and then with the right kind of a connector on the end of it, he attaches that to the handy-talkie. Because of the extra altitude of that external antenna, that handy-talkie signal that's now noisy could easily be 20 decibels or 30 decibels stronger because you've added that external antenna. Altitude is what really makes VHF work well. So using another antenna at a higher location that you connect to it could make a huge performance. 20 dB is a 100-to-1 ratio. That signal getting to the repeater could be 100 or maybe 1,000, 30 dB, 1,000 times stronger because of your higher altitude external antenna that you've added to that handy-talkie. You get the equivalent performance of standing on the roof of your house with that handy-talkie held at arm's length as high as you could reach in the air by using that external antenna with the cable coming down into the house connected to the handy-talkie while you're sitting on the couch in the living room. So certainly consider that. It's not a big investment, but it can give you a lot of performance. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, AC2GS, by the way. As they say in radio, elevation, elevation, elevation. I had the experience even here. When I first got my license and such, I stuck a little ground plane off of my second floor awning and had terrible signals and could barely get to the Limark repeater. So I thought I was going to trick the physics in the world, and I bought myself an amplifier, and I got something pretty good. I went from 5 watts to about 120 watts, and you know what? Didn't matter at all. It didn't make that much of a difference. I raised the antenna 30, 40 feet. It makes a heck of a difference. So elevation. People apparently have problems with the capacitive coupling concept. They don't sort of realize that they're part of their handy talkies antenna system.
Yeah, one of the experiments many of us have done is to open up the connector on the back of the radio while you're listening to a signal, and as you're pulling the connector away, you watch the S-meter go down, but you're still hearing the signal. You may have a gap of a quarter of an inch between the center conductor of the coaxial cable and the center conductor of the connector on the receiver. You've got a great big air gap there, and you're still hearing the signal. Is that signal jumping across that air gap? Well, in a way it is. By way of the geometry of the probe from the coax cable and the socket center conductor on the receiver, by way of that geometry and the spacing, it might be, let me pick a number, a 2 picofarad coupling capacitor in air. 2 conductors with a certain spacing and a certain area between them. There's ways of evaluating that geometry and coming up with a good estimation of the number of picofarad. At 14 megacycles, a 2 picofarad capacitor is something like a 5,000 ohm capacitive reactance. So if I had a perfect connector at first, and now I separate the connector so I have this 5,000 ohm capacitive reactance added, assuming the receiver is a pure 50 ohm load, and I've now added this series 5,000 ohms of capacitive reactance, I end up with something like a 40 decibel insertion loss because I've done that. It doesn't mean the signal went to zero. It got 40 decibels weaker. Let me drop. If the signal you were listening to on your receiver was 50 dB above threshold, it might have been 15 dB out of the noise. Because of all the noise you're getting on that band, the signal might have been 15 dB out of the noise, but the signal plus its noise might have been 50 dB above the threshold of the receiver. And you've added a 40 dB loss by creating that gap. That signal is still 10 dB above threshold. The automatic gain control of the receiver readjusts itself. The S-meter goes down, but because the AGC is readjusted, what comes out of the loudspeaker is almost identical. So that capacitive coupling gives you an insertion loss, and that insertion loss, by the way, gets smaller and smaller when you get to higher and higher frequencies. The same number of picofarads, 1 over 2 pi square root of L, 1 over 2 pi RC, here we go, 1 over 2 pi FC is the capacitive reactance. As you go to a higher frequency, you're dividing by a bigger frequency. So if I had 5,000 ohms of capacitive reactance because of 2 picofarad at 14 megacycles, at 140 megacycles, the 5,000 ohms goes down to 500 ohms and so on. Your capacitive reactance gives you more and more coupling at higher and higher frequencies for the same number of picofarads. So that explains how you still hear the signal, and it seems mysterious. And other than the S-meter going down, there are times when it sounds the same. By the same token, let me drop. You might have a beautiful high-gain Yagi antenna on the roof that you connect with that coax cable. You unplug that cable and you plug in a radio piece of clip lead wire that's only 5 feet long, and you connect that to the center conductor of the receiver. The S-meter doesn't deflect very much, but you still hear a beautiful signal by a very similar process. You weaken the signal by 20 dB by going from the good antenna to your 5-foot-long piece of wire. But the automatic gain control readjusts. And because on HF frequencies, the band noise is so loud, when you create that extra friction loss, the noise is getting weaker, the signal is getting weaker, but the ratio between the two stays the same. Automatic gain control readjusts. The S-meter goes down to a lower reading, but what comes out of the loudspeaker sounds almost the same. When the first time you do that, it seems strange. and you now say to yourself, gee, I received so well on that 5-foot piece of wire. Can I transmit through it? Uh-oh. As a transmitting device, that 5-foot piece of wire probably has a 1,000-to-1 standing wave ratio. Let me drop it. Not only has it got a lot of decibels of insertion loss compared to the real antenna, but it's an extremely bad impedance match. A receiver is very forgiving. A receiver, for a whole bunch of reasons, can tolerate a very high standing wave ratio and keep on working. Transmitter ain't that tolerant. You exceed on many of these rigs a 1.5 or a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, and your transmitter is going to start complaining real fast. That 5-foot piece of wire with its 200-to-1 standing wave ratio, you ain't going to be able to transmit with that. The next door neighbor will hear you, but you're not going to get very far. So that seems to be a violation of reciprocity. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Question.
Go ahead, Wes.
So in other words, you're saying that you have not perfectly matched antenna, and you have a means by adjusting the capacitive component of impedance. You actually make a tuning circuit. Interesting.
When you slowly extract your connector of a good antenna from the receiver, the capacitive coupling allows some signal to keep flowing through, and with the automatic gain control adjusting itself, what you'll hear sounds the same. Could you then transmit that way? I think the answer is no. Does the receiver do impedance matching? That's not what I'm saying. So, a long length piece of random wire connected to the receiver will allow you to hear almost everything that you hear with a good antenna, in some cases. That's what I'm saying. And a receiver is very forgiving. You can have a pretty high standing wave ratio, and the receiver, because of its automatic gain control and other factors, it will keep right on receiving. Your transmitter is not forgiving. It's pretty persnickety. It wants to see something very close to a 50 ohm resistive load in order to get full power output of that transmitter. That's what I'm saying, Wes. Back to you on that, Wes, K2RIW.
But I have a problem with it. 50 ohm is just the standard. But the transmitting frequency, the best transmitting frequency is, if I remember correctly, 34 ohms. And the receiving frequency is 17H. It is just that we decided to, we wanted to have a something in the middle, something that would be perfect for both. So, if you're talking about a transmitter, when the impedance is less than 50 ohms, then it's even better, right?
From one very narrow band assumption, yes, but most of the time, no. There is no magic impedance for a transmitter or a receiver. I could make an extremely high-performance receiver with an impedance of 600 ohms, 300 ohms, 100 ohms, 50 ohms, 10 ohms, 1 ohm. I could design a receiver to have very high performance with those numbers of ohms of its impedance. And if I'm doing a good job on designing the antenna, I can make the antenna design present that impedance. There is no magic impedance for transmitting or receiving. If I'm using coaxial cable, there are some apparent impedances that appear to be slightly magic. If I want the lowest possible insertion loss with the usual method of construction of a coaxial cable, let me drop. You get the lowest insertion loss at around 72 ohms. If I want the highest possible power handling capability of the coaxial cable before it arcs over, I would make the cable 37 ohms. So highest possible transmitting, 37 ohms. Lowest possible insertion loss, 72 ohms. 50 ohms is sort of a compromise between the two. For physical construction reasons and because of the impedance compromise, we've settled on 50 as a kind of a standard. There's nothing magic about 50. There's many a transistor which has an input impedance of 5 ohms. And the strip line circuitry between the input connector, the impedance matching circuit that's on the printed circuit board, and the input of that transistor is adapting between the 50 ohms of the input connector and the 5 ohms of the input terminal of the transistor. That works like a charm. So, in the real world, there is no magic impedance. You think there are some magic numbers because of certain ways of thinking about the problem. Very few of us go to a high power transmitter so high that we're likely to arc over the semiconductor. So the 37 ohms really doesn't do us any good. And except for the guy who is laying out a cable television system across a town where he has to convey that television signal across the 50 miles of the diameter of the town, he cares about the insertion loss, and he, the cable TV company guy, is going to use 70 ohm cable. But you and I don't make our cables that long, so 70 ohms usually doesn't do us any magic. And we, as I said again, we don't run that high of power where arc over is a problem, so 37 ohms doesn't do us any magic. The fact that most instrumentation in the United States is set up for transmitters and receivers and everything else for 50 ohm on the connector on the front panel, that's just a standard. There's a lot of places in Europe where their instrumentation is all set up for 70 ohms. So is there a best impedance? Depends on who you talk to. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW on the TechNet.
One more thing. I'm kind of confused with one thing. You said in one single frequency, you may agree with me. A loop antenna is very narrow in nature, in tuning. So each frequency, each individual frequency you tune the loop antenna at would be one single frequency. Don't you agree with that?
I don't think I do. If I build a full wavelength loop antenna where the plane of the loop is parallel to the ground, I'd mount it at 60 feet in the air, and it's a full wavelength on, say, 80 meters. That's not a narrow band antenna. Full size. If I shrink it down in size as a loop antenna and make it multiple turns, and I've made the whole thing a 5 foot diameter loop, yeah, that's an extremely high Q, very narrow band antenna. But you allow, that's one kind of magnetic loop antenna, but you allow me to make a full size magnetic loop antenna, it'll have a reasonable standing wave ratio across the whole damn 80 meter band, Roy. There we go, Wes. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Thank you very much for that. So when we're dealing with very narrow, small, mostly, antennas, then each single frequency is actually any frequency that you tune to. So by that, if we have a means by controlling the capacitive reactance on the connector, now we have a means of tuning. And to actually...
Yeah, George, recognize. Stand by. If I have a great enough range of my antenna tuner, I can make anything work. But a universal law of antennas is if I make the physical dimension of the antenna half wavelength, wavelength, or so, I'm going to get usually reasonably broadband impedance match, broad frequency range. Any antenna that has a physical dimension that is a small fraction of a wavelength is by the... I can't think of the guy's name right now. I'll think of his name in a minute. The two guys who have written articles in 1947-48 IEEE proceedings on electrically small antennas. When you make the antenna electrically small in wavelengths, by definition, the two-wheeler criteria. If the physical dimension of the antenna is small in wavelengths, by a predictable amount, the Q will go high. The frequency operating bandwidth will be small. And that doesn't stop it from working. It just makes the impedance matching problem a hell of a lot more difficult, and your antenna tuner is going to have to work a lot harder. And you have to try a lot harder to make sure that you're not using lossy components in that antenna tuner, that tuning assembly. George, go right ahead. KC2FIU, I think it is. K2LIW.
KD2FIU, it's George. Thank you, Dick. A couple of transmissions ago, you had mentioned a factor that was not considered, or I believe was not considered, and that's called the Q factor, and you brought that in. And from my experience, an antenna tuned with high Q on different bands will actually eliminate receive. And noted by experience with different antennas, that multiple band HF antennas that were tuned either with tuning rods or traps, if you fall out of that band, even the receive drops off incredibly. So thank you for interjecting the terminology of Q. Q factor is also important on receive. It's not just impedance. It's just not the length of the element or anything. But if your elements have capacitive Q tuning in there, you will need a transmit or receive out of that band.
Let me reword it. I think you and I are in agreement, but let me reword it. The Chu Wheeler, Mr. Harold Wheeler, and I don't know Mr. Chu's last name, they both wrote articles, 1947, 1948, IEEE proceedings, maybe microwave theory and techniques, on the subject of electrically small antennas. What kind of bandwidth can you get out of the antenna? And this factor called Q, which really, Q has got five separate definitions. One definition of Q is bandwidth divided by center frequency. Another definition is voltage rise at resonance. Another one is current rise at resonance. Another one is holding time. In other words, rise time and fall time. Another one is the rate of change of reactance versus frequency. So it sounds like five different criteria. They're all the exact same laws of physics, just five different ways of looking at it. So whenever you're using an electrically small antenna, its Q goes high. Its bandwidth of operation becomes smaller. If its bandwidth of operation is smaller, then the bandwidth over which it receives the signal is by definition smaller. On top of that, a high Q antenna that's tuned to 3,700 kilohertz, the middle of the 80-meter band, is going to have very little reception at 4.0 megacycles, 4,000 kilohertz. 4 megahertz. So it's going to fall off real fast. Q is sometimes difficult to live with. It makes your antenna tuner have to work real hard. However, every small antenna, by the Q Wheeler criteria, will have high Q. However, let me drop this. An equally important factor that's in McGraw-Hill, 1950, I can't think of his name, Krauss, the electrically small antenna gives you full performance. An infinitesimal dipole that is properly impedance matched at that operating frequency gives you full performance of the full half-wave dipole. Of course that sounds crazy. Where is all that performance coming from? The high Q. The high Q is making, when you're transmitting, very strong local magnetic fields and electrostatic fields. And so there's a great big field around that antenna, so electronically it starts acting like it's a full-size half-wave dipole, even though your dipole is only a tenth of a wavelength long. An 80-meter dipole should be 132 feet long, half-wave. I can build it 32 feet long instead of a half, instead of 132 feet long. I subtracted 100 feet of its length. If I got the right kind of a tuning arrangement at the center of that dipole, and it's a low-loss structure, at least at the one frequency I've tuned it to, at that altitude, I'll get the exact same performance. You say that on 20 meters, and a tremendous number of guys will say, you're wasting the frequency, get off here, you're crazy. Let me drop. I mean, one of the guys who we worship, Krauss, the head of the electrical engineering department in Ohio for a good number of years, wrote some very well published and accepted books, said this, made measurements to prove it. The average person thinks that when I take the antenna and I cut it down to one-tenth its size, I'm going to have either one-tenth or one-hundredth the amount of effective capture area. Not true. As long as I've used low-loss materials and I re-resonate that antenna, At that frequency, I get full performance. It may only be a kilohertz wide instead of 50 kilohertz wide. You QSY a little bit, and you've got to do a whole lot of retuning. It's not easy to live with, but it can give you full performance. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. And I think you're saying that your experience is counter to that, is what I think you're saying, George. KD2FIU, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Dick, what I'm doing is I'm agreeing that the fact that you interjected a few minutes ago, Q, was not being considered when we were when I was listening to impedance and SWR matching and everything. When you injected that, it brought into mind the fact that we can only transmit within a certain amount of bandwidth when we have a high Q resonance, and I'm glad you brought that in. I was complimenting on that because a lot of what was going on was not considering that. I had a lot of experience with antennas with decoupling rods, and traps and all of that, where if you traveled out of that bandwidth that it was designed for, you heard very, very little of signal strength going on. So I was complimenting the fact that you brought in the factor of Q a few transmissions back.
Question.
Yeah, Q is a double-edged sword. Quite often it gives you a disadvantage if you want a lot of bandwidth and you don't want to go through the rigmarole of retuning every time you QSY. That's the quasi-bad news of Q. Q of a high Q, small structure, allows you to restore the original full capture area you had for a full-size structure. Q has a benefit in that high Q allows you to get frequency selectivity. Every narrowband filter you have ever built or used, let me drop. Every narrowband bandpass filter, by definition, has high Q. That's how it does its selectivity. Now, the word Q, is it good or bad? None of the above. Everything that we've ever used has a finite Q. The final tank circuit of your transmitter has a certain Q. The transmission line, with its length and the way you tune things on the end of it, an antenna tuner at one end and the antenna on the other end, it's a kind of a bandpass filter. It has a Q. The antenna has a Q. It could be low, it could be high. Every one of the RF circuits we work with, the bandpass filter in the front end of the receiver has a certain Q. The local oscillator resonating circuit of your oscillator for your receiver has a certain Q. So Q is an important factor. As I said, it's got those five definitions. And there are many. If you're smart enough, you can almost always use it to your advantage. And understand the occasional disadvantage it's got to give you. And it has to do that by the laws of physics. Call it the true Wheeler criteria, if you like. Over to you, Wes. You had a question on all of this. K2LIW.
We weren't talking about a Q because the discussion started from walkie-talkie and one single frequency. For single size band, the standard is 2.4 kHz, sometimes 2.7. For FM, 6 kHz. We're assuming that we're using walkie-talkie at one single frequency, and we're using the antenna that was made for it. And we implement a certain mismatch. By that, we didn't care much about Q. We cared about the impedance match, and that's why capacitive reactance was important, and transient.
Yeah, when it comes to that handy-talkie, Q of the rubber duck and the rest of the structure almost doesn't matter. By that I mean, assuming now that your FM signal is running plus or minus 5 kilohertz of FM deviation, and with its sidebands, you'd like the passband to be at least 12 kilohertz wide, I'm going to say. 12 kilohertz of bandwidth at 144 megahertz. You're never going to get any reasonable antenna circuit or transmitter final tank circuit or whatever. In none of those cases is the Q going to be high enough that 15 kilohertz of bandwidth is a restriction for you at a center frequency of 144 megahertz. I'm going to do that calculation right now. 144 megahertz. And, okay, I did it wrong. 144, enter, not multiply. And, let's see, I want 12 kilohertz, 0.012 megahertz. I'd have to have a Q of 12,000 in order to get a restriction at 2 meters of a FM modulated signal. Am I likely to run into a rubber duck with a Q of 12,000? Not a chance in the world. So Q can give you some grief. At 80 meters, you might have an antenna that's only a few kilohertz wide at 80 meters because it's a very high Q. Let me drop this.
Why didn't you take 12 kilohertz, not 6 kilohertz, no question?
I'm not going to answer that question right now. Assuming the 12 kilohertz is what I want for a response bandwidth of my FM broadcast, because by definition, FM has got plus or minus a certain amount of deviation of the FM modulation, and the Bessel sidebands have to be included in order to get a high fidelity signal through that bandpass. So, for a full, ordinary, narrowband FM ham radio transmission in the old days, I'd like my circuits to have 12 kilohertz of instantaneous bandwidth when I'm using plus or minus 5 kc of deviation. I want to include some of those other Bessel sidebands. You chop them away, and I'm chopping away some of the high-frequency response of the signal I'm trying to send through there. So, am I likely to get a Q of 12,000 at 2 meters to restrict that? Not a chance in the world. But a small diameter magnetic loop antenna that's only a couple of feet in diameter at 80 meters, will I have trouble passing that single sideband signal a couple of kilohertz wide? Probably not. If I was transmitting FM down there, would I have trouble passing the signal? Quite possibly so. So, at certain places, the Q can give you some grief. But now, when you do the calculation, you find out whether or not the Q is giving you a restriction. I know we've gotten somewhat off the subject. Maybe Roy is going to get us back on the subject here. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
No, it's all quite fascinating. I think the moral of the story ultimately is a shortwave listener has a much easier life than we do.
Yes, he does, because he doesn't have to transmit. And you could say the receiver appears to be very forgiving. But if you want full performance out of a VHF receiver, where the noise on the band is quite a bit quieter, some of these things that don't affect you on HF are going to affect you. If this is the best of all worlds on 432, I'd like to have a 1 dB noise figure receiver. I'd like to have zero insertion loss between that antenna, the feed line, and the radio shack. It might, to get full performance, I might require a line-driving preamplifier mounted at the antenna in order to do good satellite reception. So there are places where these factors are very important. And do you need a line-driving preamplifier on your 80-meter antenna? Not a chance in the world, with rare exception. Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Well, agreed. As far as high Q is problematic, it sort of depends upon the high Q antenna. My magnetic loop is locked in and tuned to one specific frequency. It has a very high Q that all magnetic loops have, but it has a low noise, high gain preamp that kind of saves its bacon. So, again, surprisingly, receivers, you can tweedle them and adjust them and get away with things. You can't break the law of physics, but you can bend them a little.
What's the brand name on that tunable magnetic loop antenna, which I think has got a lot of ferrite in it? What's that brand name, and what's the approximate cost of that? And I think you use it across a big section of the HF band and even on broadcast. Isn't that true, Roy?
Yeah, I've used it to receive AM broadcast signals all the way up. It's not very good at 10 meters, but it kind of gives up the ghost past 20 meters. It used to be the Pixel Pro 1B, I think, was its designation. Now it was sold to DX Engineering, and they sell it for about $400 and change.
And I think you're saying when you use, I think you're saying that when you use it on amplitude modulated AM broadcast, that it's about the best receiving antenna you've ever used, even including a long wire in the backyard.
Yeah, it beats a long wire in the backyard. I haven't really tried that many different antennas listening to broadcast AM because, you know, it's kind of using a mallet to drive in a thumbtack. But, yeah, it was surprisingly good. I had my doubts before I turned the dial and set my flex to general coverage, but I was happily surprised.
What's the best DX you've had with that, Roy?
You're sort of asking the wrong guy. I don't really listen a lot to distant broadcasts. I mean, I just listened locally and made a little note that that I was picking things up. But I don't know, sitting around and listening to fading signals, I mean, sometimes I'll hit the record button and go away, and then I'll see what it records. But I don't have the patience for DX listening anymore these days. I got one more question in my mailbag, Dick.
Fire away.
Okay, this one is not as descriptive as I wish it was, so it's open to interpretation. But the gentleman says he has a scanner that's an 8-inch round antenna, which sticks out of the top straight out, much like a portable handheld, he says. If I set it on the counter and tune to a station, just by turning the scanner on the counter to a different direction, I change the strength of the signal received. Yet the antenna is round. Why does it matter what direction the scanner itself is facing?
I have some guesses on this one. And, as an example, I'm going to use a mobile installation on an automobile. If I mount an antenna on my automobile on the rear left-hand side of the bumper, the major mass of the automobile is toward the, from that antenna's point of view, is toward the right forward bumper. So the signal will be stronger in that direction. So a mobile installation, when the antenna is in one of the corners of the car, you get the stronger signal in the direction of the mass center of the car. In the case of that WIP antenna on his scanner receiver, most likely the WIP is not in the center of that package. It's off to one corner of the package. So even though the antenna is a pure vertical metallic object and it's round, you'd like to believe it has a purely azimuthal, a non-directional antenna pattern in azimuth. Not true. Let me drop it. If that antenna is mounted in one of the corners of that box, and if now you put that box on a turntable in a good anechoic chamber and measure the antenna pattern, most likely you're going to find a stronger signal in the direction of the maximum mass of the box, if you know what I mean, very similar to the mobile installation. That's part of what's going on. Another part of what's going on is that you think the box is the counterpoise for that WIP antenna. That's not the only counterpoise. There's a coupling capacitor in there to make sure that RF energy doesn't get in by way of the 110-volt line cord. That 110-volt line cord is RF grounded to that box. That line cord is coming off at some crazy angle. That's also part of the counterpoise, giving you a directional antenna pattern. Now, maybe his scanner is running on a battery, and maybe that doesn't matter. But there's a hell of a lot of things going on here. Because of the multipath of the room, he thinks he is rotating the scanning receiver on the table and getting a different antenna pattern. Well, the actual WIP antenna is not in the exact same location when he rotates the scanning receiver. And therefore, the way all of the multipath in his room is taking place is adding up all of those signals with a slightly different phase angle into that WIP antenna when it's in its new address. So, RF energy. We all want to think that nothing but the direct path signal occurs directly at right angles to the metallic antenna. It's nowhere near that simple. Assuming that the antenna was doing transmitting, that signal is bouncing off everything in his environment. Even the metal braces that are underneath that table that hold the legs up correctly, that's part of that antenna pattern. His arm, the reflections off all the things in the room, the metal objects that are part of the table that his eye doesn't see, the other objects in the room. So you make any change of an antenna...
Repeater, time out.
Make any change of an antenna's X, Y, and Z position, or its X, Y, and Z orientation, and you'll get an entirely different performance. So that's part of what I think he is experiencing. Once he becomes more and more familiar with multipath and the chirality effects of that, some of the compound reflections you get off the objects in your room have the ability to take a purely vertically polarized signal and making it horizontal. Under some conditions, the objects that are reflecting in your room are capable of taking a purely vertically polarized signal and making it into circular or elliptical polarization. Multipath can do that. That's called chirality. Over to you, Roy. AC2GS, K2LIW.
AC2GS here. I interpreted the question differently than you did, Dick. He describes it as an 8-inch round antenna, which makes me think it's sort of like one of those small loop antennas that people used to use on UHF on the back of their old TV sets. I thought of it in my mind's eye as a small loop. I don't know if it's horizontally or vertically oriented because he doesn't really mention, but that's the image that I'm getting from that question.
But even if it is one of those wire loop antennas, that wire loop antenna could have a substitute antenna that is a monopole with a particular orientation. The antenna pattern of the loop and the antenna pattern of that substitute monopole with proper orientation could be a very similar antenna pattern. For most of us, it's rather difficult to envision the antenna pattern of a wire loop antenna. If the wire loop antenna is set up perpendicular to the ground, the plane of it is perpendicular to the ground, usually, with the usual way of feeding that thing, it is a vertically polarized antenna which favors the plane of the loop and tends to give you a null in the performance normal to that loop. That's the usual antenna pattern you get out of that, which is pretty similar to a particular dipole with a particular orientation. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
Yes, I mean, that's what I thought the ultimate answer was, that the antenna that he's using might be circular, but it's not isotropic. It's not omnidirectional. It has particular angles that it receives much better at. I mean, a lot of people are deeply confused by loop antennas. For some odd reason, they look through the loop and they think that's the directionality of the signal when it's at a right angle to looking through the loop. So I thought that was the question, but again, I wasn't quite sure if it was a horizontally oriented loop or a vertically oriented loop, which is shows far less directionality.
E2FIU.
George recognized, with the usual way of feeding a loop antenna, the pattern of a loop antenna is very similar to a dipole that is oriented down the axis of the loop. So a dipole at right angles to the plane of the loop, down the axis of the loop, the radiation pattern of that dipole and the radiation pattern of that loop are very similar. Over to you, George, K2LIW.
I look at it as where the signal originates from. The polarization can be pure from where the signal originates from, and going back to maybe 40, 45 minutes ago, Dick, from what you were saying, as it bounces off so much going on around us. The polarization is not going to be pure by how much? How much in the vicinity around us? In the bathroom, it was very different. Back to the HT. Was it very different because one pole of energy coming out of the rubber duck was conductive to the plumbing, or was it my body being conductive, the other pole of energy being conductive to the cast iron standpipe in the building, which is common to where most bathrooms are built in buildings or homes? So going back to it is, we have an origination of polarization, and how does it revolve out beyond us? KD2FIU.
I agree with you, George. Those are all complicating factors. I'm not a big factor in that handy-talkie in my bathroom. I can walk out of the bathroom, and the performance stays the same of that horizontal handy-talkie on the plastic shelf. And if I set up vertical on the plastic shelf, the signal gets quite a bit weaker, whether I'm in the bathroom or not in the bathroom. So I'm a minor factor in that particular environment. The standpipe is probably a more dominating factor, as well as the Dix Hills water tower that's in my vicinity. OD Roy, is that most of the mailbag for this week? AC2GS, and I think we're about to get some science and physics. You got it, Roy. K2LIW.
Yes, indeed. Just in time, we have emptied at least 2.5 weeks' worth of the mailbag. It is empty, waiting to be filled up by anyone interested. Again, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com, and I guess we'll mosey on down to the science talk.
One quick break, Roy. I wonder if you had a chance to see that photograph of that so-called metal tape 2-meter Yagi antenna. It's kind of a pretty looking thing. I wonder if you had a chance to see that picture.
Yes, I did. Matter of fact, I replied to David last night when he first sent the email, and I suggested rather than dealing with some kind of limpy piece of wire that was eventually going to bend out of shape, that he try the steel measuring tapes. I've seen a lot of them. They can be done very nicely. There's a little problem in getting the connections because of the steel, but if you get past that problem, it makes for a very, very nice portable Yagi.
Glad to hear it. Please proceed.
Okay, this is AC2GS with Science Talk or anything else you want to call this. And again, keep in mind that if there are topics or questions that you might be interested in, then please send them to me care of mailbag@ac2gs.com. For tonight, we're going to revisit the ISS because everyone enjoyed it so much last week. So let me drop for a sec. In our last episode, we were discussing how the ISS, circling the Earth at approximately 245 miles above ground, only has a 3% view of the Earth. I now ask you the next question about the ISS. As we all know, gravity is the force that keeps us whole here on the planet Earth. And the force of gravity is stated as the constant G at ground level. As we go higher and higher, farther and farther away from good old planet Earth, the amount of G-forces become less and less and less until out there in outer space can't be felt. So my question tonight for the audience is, what do you think is the percentage of the gravitational force of the planet Earth as measured in the International Space Station? Care to guess? You can guess 1%, you can guess 99%, you can guess 50%.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George.
I don't know the exact percentage, but if it's going to maintain an orbit, you got to consider the distance, you got to consider its mass, and you got to consider its velocity. So all of that is going to, give it its relative orbital speed. Its speed is going to give you your factor. Its mass is going to give you a factor, and I don't know the answer, and I can't calculate that, but that's Newtonian.